We'd like to call the Subcommittee on Employee Relations to order here and welcome everybody here on such a kind of a gloomy afternoon, but we're going to get through this and move forward here as quickly as possible. So why don't we do this so everybody knows everyone at the table here. Let's start over here and just have a quick introduction.
Senator Ted Daly representing Eagan, a little bit of Burnsville.
Michelle Benson representing Hamlet, Andover, Coon Rapids.
Stephanie James, Senate Counsel.
Senator Mike Perry representing Senate District 26, Owatonna, Faribault, and Waseca.
I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations.
Representative Steve Dreskowski represent portions of Wabasha, Goodhue, and Winona County.
Keith Downey, District 41A, representing Edina.
Representative Mike Benson representing Olmsteads and Wabasha counties.
If you would move that microphone so that your brother can hear what you just said.
I tried to get his parking spot, but he wouldn't text me back.
Ryan Winkler representing Golden Valley and St. Louis Park.
All right. Thank you all for being here at this organizational meeting. The second item on the agenda is the election of officers. There are three that we will be electing here this afternoon. First to be the chair. So we will open up nominations for that.
I'll nominate Senator Mike Perry.
All right. Any further nominations? All right. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. All right. The second will be the position of vice chair. We'll open nominations at this time.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to nominate Representative Dreskowski.
All right. Representative Dreskowski has been nominated. Any further nominations? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. And the final position that we need to vote on is the position of secretary, which involves quite a huge duty, I understand. Is there a nomination?
Yeah. I would like to nominate Representative Winkler for that position.
Any further nominations?
I'd like to nominate Senator Metzen.
All right. We have Senator Winkler or Representative Winkler and Senator Metzen have been nominated. Any further nominations?
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain speeches?
I'm not used to hearing a speech to the negative on a candidacy here. So,
Mr. Chair, I was merely going to remind us all of the long record of service of Senator Metzen, his knowledge of legislative process and procedure, and his comfort level with managing and presiding over an important institution of the state legislature, and would strongly second his nomination.
All right. Yes.
Mr. Chair, I might also add that Senator Metzen is not here, so that may also speak to his qualifications as well. So.
All right. Well, let's move this forward. Are you withdrawing your name from the nomination, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, having not placed it in nomination, I would like to withdraw it.
All right. So be it. All those in favor of Senator Metzen being our secretary, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. So be it. Let's move on. We are charged with adopting subcommittee rules, which you all have a copy of. And before we get into that, I'm wondering if there's anyone in the audience that would want to testify on those rules as they haven't. I'm hoping that all have a copy of it. If they would like to make any comments towards that, otherwise we're going to proceed and with the committee here moving on that. All right. With that, I think the best way to start this is to have a motion to adopt the rules, and then we can open it up for discussion.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the rules as documented before the commission.
All right. Representative Downey moves the adoption of the rules. Is there any discussion? Representative Dreskowski.
Mr. Chair, I move to amend the rules, the proposed rules by Mr. Chair, on page 2, under 4.2 in the rules, appearing on lines 25 and 26, I would like to strike the words beginning at the end of line 25, and have fiscal or significant operational implications.
You would like to strike those words?
I'd like to strike those words. So that sentence, Mr. Chair, would say, any memoranda of agreement between the parties, understandings or side accords which have been agreed upon shall accompany the text of the agreement.
All right. Any discussion on that? Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just ask if Representative Drozdowski would maybe give us a rationale for that deletion.
Representative Drozdowski.
I will, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Winkler. I guess a couple of things come to mind, Mr. Chair, and that is that, looking at what is a significant operational implication or fiscal implication is certainly something that it's a judgment call by the person delivering the information. I would like to see any effects that these agreements have on the future of state government here in the state of Minnesota. I think about the effects that these have on the budget and could have on the budget, and certainly I would like to know the full implications that they have on the budget. Therefore, I think it's prudent for us to pull those qualifiers out.
Any further discussion? Anyone? Representative?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just was going to do what you were about to do to ask if we're going to be buried with paper and ask if there's anybody from the administration who could, or anyone else who could offer any thoughts on that rule, or maybe Mr. Hubinger.
Anyone in the administration like to? Or Mr. Hubinger, do you want to start out?
Mr. Chair and members, in the past, the department and Minsky, which also negotiates some contracts, have provided all information that I'm aware of in terms of MOUs or memorandums of agreement to the subcommittee. And I'm not aware, well, I don't believe that there's been this stipulation before that, or that they've acted under that, so that they've just provided all information to the subcommittee.
All right. Anyone else like to make any comments towards that? All right. Any further discussion by the committee? On the motion to amend on page 2, line 25 and 26 to delete and have fiscal significant operational implications, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment prevails. Any further discussion on the rules of the subcommittee?
Mr. Chair, I think my original motion probably should have moved the rules as before us as amended, because there were some technical amendments in the body of the rules that we were looking at.
And
so
you're still
moving
making
as amended.
As amended. So, okay. Any further discussion on the rules?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members, most of the rules reiterate what's in statute, so there's not much new there. But the piece that you should be aware of is that the subcommittee operates like a committee, not like a conference committee. So a majority of the vote of the majority of the members present constitutes an action of the subcommittee. So it's not like a conference committee where you need a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate, just so that you're aware of that.
Correct. Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask if Mr. Hubinger could provide any guidelines as to how these rules might be different from what's in statute or what's been done differently, if anything is significant, and it sounds like he's already answered that.
He was well ahead of you.
Yeah.
He told me he was going to try to stay ahead of all of us on this committee. Isn't that right?
Probably right. Not that hard.
Any further discussion on the rules? If not, we have a motion by Representative Downey to approve the rules of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations of the Legislative Coordinating Commission as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, committee. We're on agenda item number 4, review and approval of minutes of the December 16th, 2009 meeting.
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
It has been moved by Representative Lilly. Any discussion at all on those minutes? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. So moved. Review of subcommittee duties. Mr. Hubinger, do you want to kind of briefly, I know we've probably all read through it once, but kind of highlight some of the duties?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to do that. So the statutory duty to review and approve labor contracts and compensation plans is given to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The Coordinating Commission has traditionally delegated that responsibility to a subcommittee, this Subcommittee on Employee Relations, to carry out those duties. The actions of this subcommittee are final. They are not further reviewed by the full commission. Once the subcommittee acts, a contract or compensation plan is implemented. I'll go into more detail in a few minutes. But then the contract is implemented, but the actions of the subcommittee have to be ratified by the full legislature at the next session. And we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. As you know, the resolution establishing the subcommittee provides for 10 members, 5 from the House and 5 from the Senate. The chair rotates every 2 years between the House and the Senate and will be in the Senate for the next two-year period. The subcommittee has three principal areas of responsibility. The first is to review labor contracts with state employees. The second is to review and consider interim approval of compensation plans for employees who are not represented by a union. And the third is to review proposed increases in salaries for heads of state agencies. The most substantive work deals with collective bargaining agreements for state employees. There are 12 labor contracts for state employees, 9 negotiated by Minnesota Management and Budget, and 3 negotiated by Minsky for their faculty units. The subcommittee has the authority to grant interim approval of those contracts, and once approved, they go into effect. And then they must be submitted to the full legislature for review at the next session. If the full legislature does not ratify those contracts, the benefit increases and the wage increases in those contracts cease to be paid. MMB and Minsky are required to provide those contracts to us once they've reached tentative agreements with the unions within 5 days. The subcommittee has 30 days to act on those. If the subcommittee doesn't reject them in 30 days, they're considered approved and are implemented. So the deck is stacked in favor of the contracts going into effect. Labor contracts can only be approved in their entirety. The subcommittee does not have the ability to amend them. If the subcommittee chooses to reject a contract, it must specify what the reasons are for the rejection, what the subcommittee finds objectionable. If MMB or Minsky submit a labor contract during the session, the subcommittee continues to do its review, but its review is advisory only. The contract is not implemented until a bill ratifying it is passed by the legislature. The subcommittee also reviews compensation plans for unrepresented employees. This is about 10% of the state workforce. There are 4 of these compensation plans. One is the commissioner's plan, which, despite its name, is not the compensation plan for commissioners, but for a plan developed by the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. It covers confidential employees and employees who have severed from their bargaining units and some other miscellaneous groups. The second plan is the managerial plan, which sets the term and conditions of employment for state managers. The third is a similar plan for managers at Minsky. And then fourth is a small plan for unclassified administrators at the Office of Higher Education. The rules for review and compensation plan are quite different than for contracts. Compensation plan does not have a 30-day clock on it, so until the subcommittee acts on it, the plan is not implemented. The subcommittee has the ability to modify a compensation plan, which it cannot do for a labor contract. And again, the compensation plan has to be submitted to the full legislature for its review. Otherwise, the compensation plan is voided and those increases in salaries or changes in benefits go back to their original setting. The third area of responsibility deals with salaries for heads of state agencies. The governor and some other appointing authorities, such as the pension fund boards, can propose increases in salaries for their commissioners. The subcommittee has the authority to approve those increases as long as they're within the salary ranges that are established elsewhere in law. For increases that are proposed by the governor, the subcommittee has to act within 30 days where those increases are considered approved and are implemented. The subcommittee has the ability to modify or reject those proposed increases. And then finally, again, all of the work of the subcommittee, including the salary increases, have to be approved and ratified by the full legislature.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Representative Draskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions for Mr. Hubinger. Mr. Hubinger, when the subcommittee is notified about these contracts with the five-day requirement, does a notification come through you then and everybody gets a copy? Exactly kind of how is that chain of communication? How does that happen?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Draskowski, when the subcommittee receives a contract, we will notify all of the members, provide a summary to you of what's provided in the contract, and make a copy of that contract available online so that you can see, and it's in legislative format, so you can see what the changes are.
Any further questions of Mr. Hubinger? Very well done. Thank you for the explanation. Move on to number six here, update on bargaining. Commissioner Showalter is here, and Assistant Commissioner Barbara Holmes. If you two want to come forth, and we'll proceed through. Welcome. You know, when we have small committees, Commissioner, we need to shorten up these tables. Pass me the salt, you know.
Thank you for the welcome, Mr. Chair. And yes, a greetings, albeit distant greetings, from the other side of this table. Assistant Commissioner Holmes and I are here to present and provide any answers to questions that you might have. As you know, this is our first time in these roles as well, and so appreciate the committee's challenge of getting up to speed on this process, understanding what's going on. We, like you, are working through those questions and all of the many issues that go into this negotiating process. The advice of Mr. Hubinger, people on our staff are invaluable in understanding the implications of the language and the terms of these contracts. We're happy to provide information as we go along, and I believe Assistant Commissioner Holmes can provide some opening remarks and stand for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Showalter. Assistant Commissioner Holmes, I know we've spoke earlier, and my intent today was hopefully you could educate us on the past, the present, and where you're proceeding in the future. I think that will give us a good way to get up to speed on this, so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I thought that the thing that would be most helpful is to give you an idea, give the committee members an idea of the labor relations structure that we operate under in the state, and also the typical process that we use to negotiate contracts up until the point that we bring them before the committee. And some of you heard parts of this type of a presentation in a House committee last year, I believe, so there's a little repetition, but it's always probably good to hear things a couple times, at least it is for me, and since we hope to be bringing contracts in front of you. There are a couple of key dates to remember in terms of how we got to the point of having collective bargaining in the state of Minnesota. In 1935, you have the federal government approving the National Labor Relations Act, which allowed for collective bargaining and union organizing in the private sector. The public sector was never covered. In 1939 in Minnesota, the state did essentially the same thing, a labor relations law that applied to the private sector. In 1959, we have Wisconsin being the first state to extend collective bargaining rights and organizing rights to state employees. In 1970, we have the state of Minnesota coming along and granting the right to all public employees, state employees, county employees, city employees, school district employees, including teachers, to organize and be represented by unions and to bargain with the employer. The state's first experiences under this new law after 1970, what happened in the state is we had pockets of employees organizing all over the place. We might have a pocket of employees in the Department of Revenue organizing and being represented by a union. Another group of employees or another classification over here being represented by a union and negotiating with the employer. By the time of 1979, we actually had 116 different groups of employees. We had 20 different unions and 33 separate collective bargaining agreements, and that posed a lot of problems. So the legislature came up with a new solution to address this issue, and that was the advent of occupationally based bargaining units. I believe you have a handout that's been provided that lists all of the current bargaining units in the state. Has that been passed out?
Yep.
Correct.
So if you look on the left-hand side of the page, you see the occupationally based bargaining units that were established in law. The Bureau of Mediation Services went through a process and assigned every job classification into one of these units. And then if the employees wanted to organize, they did so. And what you see on the right side of the page is the listing of the unions that represent the various bargaining units. And I think you can see that AFSCME represents a number of those units, and we actually bargain with them for most all of those units rather than separately. You can also see listed on there the number of employees as of May 2010 in those various units. State employees are not required to be full members of the unions, but they are required, if they choose not to be full members of the unions, to pay what's called a fair share fee. Because regardless of whether they're full members, they are covered by the labor contracts. They have all the protections and rights that are negotiated by the union. So the thinking behind that is, since the union has spent considerable time negotiating the contract, that those employees that benefit by it should also contribute something toward the expenses of the unions. And that's why we have what we call fair share fees. Fair share fees are limited in statute to 85% of the full union dues. And the various unions vary in terms of how they come in terms of the percentages of fair share fees. We traditionally bargain 2-year contracts based on our biennial budget cycle. They follow the same dates of July 1st of an odd-numbered year to June 30th, 2 years later. When we bargain, we only have to address what's called terms and conditions of employment. That's, of course, a legal term, and there are all sorts of items that could be considered terms and conditions of employment. The most obvious ones are wages, are other type of benefits, of health insurance benefits, life insurance benefits, vacations, holidays. Those sorts of things are the items that we're required to negotiate with the unions. You all are aware, I'm sure, that we do not negotiate pension benefits. In some states, pension benefits do get involved in the negotiation process, but by statute, we do not, and you're all aware of the Legislative Pension Commission, and that's where legislation affecting those benefits is initially reviewed and then passed on to the full legislature. Mr. Hubinger mentioned that we have 12 separate labor contracts that cover about 90% of state of Minnesota employees. MMB negotiates 9 of those contracts. MNSCU negotiates the other 3. So if you look at the handout that was provided of the list of bargaining units, if you look at bargaining units 9, 10, and 11, those are the collective bargaining contracts that MNSCU negotiates, and we negotiate the remainder of them. We typically begin negotiations sometime in February or March before the end of the budget setting legislative session. Prior to that point, going into negotiations, we spend a lot of time with our agencies and our managers and our supervisors and the HR directors coming up with contract proposals to make. We listen to them regarding areas of operations where perhaps the contract isn't working for them, and from that sort of input, we develop proposals. There's also a labor relations staff that I supervise. We deal in these contract interpretation issues day in and day out, advising the agencies, so my staff also generates ideas for proposals, since we're aware on a day-to-day basis where there are problems or where improvements can be made. Our bargaining team, the management side of the bargaining team, is comprised of several members of my staff. I am the chief negotiator for the AFSCME contract, and there are other people on my staff who are the chief negotiators for some of the other contracts. The bargaining team is comprised mainly of the chief negotiators, some members of my staff, and also members of the human resources community. A lot of HR directors from the community, from the state, sit on our bargaining team so that they have the data, they know what the day-to-day is like. And so when we're looking at proposals that the union has made or when we're reviewing our proposals, we have to have input from them because they really know what the impact is at their agency level. We have a slightly different process for insurance negotiations for benefits. We don't commence negotiations with individual unions on insurance benefits. What we start off with is a coalition of all union members. Each union that you see listed here sends several members, and they form their own coalition for bargaining. We meet with them with several members of our employee insurance division, and we begin insurance negotiations to negotiate the same package with all of them. That's what has worked in the past. That works very nicely in a lot of different ways, and that's the reason we do that. At some point, when insurance negotiations are going on at the same time as we start with AFSCME and MAPE negotiations, they're all sort of simultaneously happening, and we'll get to the end when we start dealing with the wages and the costs of the insurance package. The insurance negotiations kind of end for the coalition, and AFSCME and MAPE then continue to bargain the final cost provisions with us on employee insurance contributions. We have made our opening proposals to AFSCME, to MAPE. We did this in May. They have made their opening proposals to us, and we had one meeting on insurance issues in May. Normally, we wait to see when the budget is finalized, and we do a lot of our final work, our hard work, in the month of June when we know what the budget is. Because that didn't happen this year, we instead in June we were negotiating an MOU to handle a state employee shutdown, and then we had the shutdown in July. So our bargaining process got interrupted significantly, but we are back on track. We have several bargaining dates. We're going back into insurance negotiations this Monday and the following Friday. We have some negotiation dates set with me and asked me also to deal with the other issues of the contract. I think you're all aware that our contracts technically expire on July 1st, it expired on June 30th of this past year. And there is a statute that says until you have a new contract negotiating that the terms of the existing contract continue. And this was a contract that was, of course, negotiated under the Pawlenty administration that's continuing. We are in the middle of bargaining right now, and it's difficult for me I certainly can't discuss with you strategy issues or make a lot of comments on what's going on in bargaining. I think probably more than any other group, you, the legislature, understands a bargaining process and the need to keep it between the parties and what bringing in outside people like the press, what that does to the process. And so I can't tell you too much more than that today, except that we do have bargaining dates and we will continue bargaining to reach an agreement to bring before you. The plan is I am in contact with Greg Hubinger on a regular basis and can provide him with updates, and that I will also then be updating Chairman Perry.
All right, thank you very much. Questions at this point? Representative Benson.
In terms of your negotiations over the insurance plans, are you to the point where they've been passed now to the AFSCME and MAPES representatives? Are you still with the groups that you originally started with?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, Representative Benson, excuse me. We are still with the coalition.
Further questions? Representative Druskowski. Or excuse me, Tony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Holmes, just some process questions because I've never been involved in this before. So it sounds like this committee doesn't really have any visibility into the original offers or anything like that until the process is complete. If you can confirm that for me. And then is any of that kind of history of the negotiations public record? Do we ever have any ability on this committee to see that or understand kind of where we started and where we ended up?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, we've never been, no one's ever been interested in getting into the details of the proposals, and that typically doesn't happen. Those are things that take place at the table. We certainly do have some historical records and about those sorts of things, and I would have to check with our data practices people, but I imagine that they are available since negotiations for past years are completed.
Representative Downey, I'll clarify a little bit because Commissioner Holmes and I have been discussing that same concern, and she understands my concern about being on somewhat the same wavelength of what we believe can move forward. And I think we both agree that in the negotiating process there's a certain confidentiality. Not that we don't want everyone to weigh in on it, but I think it takes the negotiating, and you well know that if everything's laid out on the table right out of the chute, there is no negotiating. I think we went through that in the budget cycle this year. I'm not so sure that if we did request it, I think we would be able to get that, but I think we would have to be very, very cautious on the confidentiality side of that. Commissioner Holmes, am I correctly articulating our kind of a discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, new to this. I got actually just a few questions that I would want to ask. So maybe a follow-up to that, maybe for Mr. Hubinger, the chair, or Ms. Holmes. Is it typical for this committee to kind of beyond the obvious explicit intent of the budget documents and statute and maybe some implied intent from the debate that we had during the legislative session that produced the budget, does this committee ever kind of express to the administration or the negotiating process maybe some of our intent, or do we typically just kind of wait and get the reviews of the process as appropriate and then get the final contracts? Does this committee ever weigh in? Is that a normal function?
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, the subcommittee hasn't acted on the front end of labor contracts in the recent past, but farther down the road when there is a single contract, the experience has been that when there's been a single contract that where the negotiations haven't been going well and the exclusive representative is moving towards a strike and it's raising public awareness, the subcommittee has sought input from the rest of the members of the legislature and collated that and forwarded that to the commissioner, expressing their concerns and possible solutions for the items that are at impasse.
Representative Downey, I will follow up a little bit on that. Not that I don't think anybody would be opposed to hearing the subcommittee's thoughts on a starting point, because I know I've had discussions, I believe, with both commissioners on where I believe, at least from the discussions I've had with other legislators, where I believe they should be starting at. Is that what you're getting at, to be able to say, hey, here's where we think or I think you should start?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and my questions are really exclusively just process. I wasn't sure kind of what our role is. I read the rules, and Mr. Hubinger's write-up and his presentation. I just wanted to find out whether we got a job to do before or after the contracts come to us. And I'm hearing more or less that it's after they come to us.
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and members, an additional piece, I was relating the experience. The statutory authority of the subcommittee is broad, so that at the front end, as Senator Perry was indicating, the subcommittee can indicate its beliefs about what appropriate outcomes might be.
Yeah. Representative Downey?
If I could, Mr. Chair, then a question for Ms. Holmes. So you mentioned that wages and benefits are negotiated by you. Pensions are separate. And then the concept of work rules entered my mind, too, and it seems that those four things tend to kind of be negotiated in balance with each other. And so, you know, a bargaining unit may be more interested in work rule issues than compensation in a given year or something. Are all four of those under your negotiating purview, and just the wages and benefits come to us and the other pension agreements come to the pension committee, or is that really a totally separate negotiation, and maybe just some information on how behind the scenes you're working all of those dimensions in the overall negotiation?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, when we commence negotiations with any union, the first proposals that we give them are what we call language proposals, and I think that's what you mean by work rules. So we go over all the various proposals regarding schedules and vacation and other benefits. That's what we focus on in the beginning. Simultaneously, we're doing the insurance, and then when we get to the end is when we bring the wage package in. So we do have purview over all of those topics that you mentioned, and they will be brought before you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if this question is for Mr. Hubinger or Ms. Holmes, but I'm looking at the statute on contracts 179A.20, subdivision 6, and that is the part that talks about the contracts in effect. And Ms. Holmes talked about if an agreement or if a new contract isn't reached by the 1st of July, and the understanding was that the current contract extends into the future. Looking at subdivision 6, it says, and for additional time if the parties agree. And I'm wondering what that means and what the interpretation is and what it means practically to the process. Does it need to be formally provided for, the agreement between the parties? Is that formally or is it implied, or has the governor and the exclusive representatives, have they already agreed to extend it, or what can we expect?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it was Drazkowski who was asking. Thank you. First of all, we really haven't ever been to this position, this statute. I don't think we've ever found negotiations that got to this particular provision. I want to make sure you understand, though, is to start off, it's very clear that there is no agreement we have to have right now. The terms of the expired contract continue. What the statute gets to is when you get to the right to strike. The right to strike, the union has the right to have the terms not apply anymore, but they can also agree with us to keep bargaining, go back to bargaining. So there's agreement that, yes, that can happen down the road, and it would be something that we could do informally. But currently, right now, we have no choice. We have to go in and bargain. And during that time, we have to bargain in good faith, and during that time, the terms continue. Is that what your question was?
Representative Drexkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Holmes, I think it was. As a matter of fact, I think that's helpful, and it would be interesting maybe talking to you more offline, but it sounds like the provisions of the contract are what are guiding us here. Is that what you're saying?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drexkowski, exactly.
Commissioner Holmes, that also includes one part that I'm wondering is as that contract continues to move forward, though, while the negotiating is going on now, that still includes steps and lanes and in that? Is that correct?
The current contract for the last year had built into it, as in all past years, step increases. And, yes, those continue. That's been the case, you know, that's how it's been treated. Even though we have had some contracts settle on time, most of them don't get formally approved by you till the end of the year, and the current contract always includes steps, and those are always granted.
Any other questions of the commissioners here? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I have, Ms. Holmes, is, if you start the negotiating process in March, February and March, before a budget is approved, and you exchange offers before you know, or you don't exchange, but you make an offer before you know what the total budget is, how do you build assumptions about numbers into these offers, or don't you? How does that work?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, when we start our negotiations, we, again, just start with language proposals. And it's not till usually June that we actually make a wage proposal, and the budget has been set by then.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Holmes.
Representative.
Follow-up. And you said that you made an offer this June. I think you said that. Maybe I misheard, but I thought you said that you made an offer this June. And I guess so, wondering if that's the case, and if so, if you left some. You can't give too much detail, I guess. But, I mean, how did you deal with that when there was no budget?
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, the proposals that we made in May to both AFSCME and the union were simply language proposals, so we have not put any sort of wage offer out there.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Holmes. I was just wondering, we have a few new folks on here. I was just wondering, over the last few years, what have we seen on these negotiated contracts? What has there been just rampant growth and wages that our state employees are enjoying, or what's happened? What are they experiencing? Because it just seemed like the last year I've just heard that they've just been really getting fat. So I'm just wondering where we're at, how the last couple of years have been.
Commissioner Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lilly, I believe Mr. Hubinger has the list of the last several years. I can tell you that last round of bargaining, there were no across-the-board increases, and steps were only given in the second year of the contract. The year before, Greg, do you have your list of
Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chair and members, for the 2008-2009 biennium, employees received their step increases in each year for those that were eligible. And then the average across the board increase in each of the 2 years was 3.25%.
Okay.
Should I do one more?
Sure.
The biennium before that, for the 2006 and 2007 biennium, employees received step increases in each year, and the average step, or the average across the board increase, was 2% in each of the 2 years. We have settlement sheets where we track these contracts and the cost. That's one of the primary documents that we have for the subcommittee. They're all posted on the subcommittee's website. We have a link for that on the bottom of that summary that we were going through before. I'd also be glad to meet with each of you to go through how that sheet works. It's a little bit complicated.
All right. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hubinger, I thought I remembered the effect of the steps and lanes, though, from the last biennium being about a 1.9% increase in most of the bargaining units, the effect that they have beyond the fact that there was zero across the board expressed, the cost to government was a 1.9% increase. Is that pretty close?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, the impact of the bottom line that the subcommittee uses for labor contracts is the impact of those contracts on the next biennium when all of those increases will be paid for the entire two-year period. The impact of the last set of contracts on the biennium that we're starting now, we tallied at it 1.69%, very close to year 1.9. A third of that was the increased cost in health insurance, and another third was increased contributions to pensions that were required by legislation in 2008, I believe it was.
Representative Benson.
Some of this might have been answered, I guess, with the answer that Mr. Hubinger just gave in terms of the increase could be calculated. My assumption is, though, that you've looked at if we continue with the current contract, if we hadn't opened up discussions, everything went just as the way it did, and they were satisfied, what is the current contract in relationship to the amount that was budgeted, and you know, are we going to exceed that? And by statute, are we required then, or would the bargaining units be required, are the managers of those bargaining units be required to adjust staffing levels in order to make sure that you don't exceed the budget?
Commissioner Holmes, or Showalter?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, good question. And it's a somewhat confusing issue that you bring up, because there's really two different elements of controls here. On the appropriation, that is really the total resources available to the agency to fund their operations, grants, and other activities. And so that is really the control of the resource. That's the control of all the resources that are available to run state government. How those dollars are allocated, what the terms of conditions, both in terms of economic conditions, insurance, work rules, those are included in the labor contract. So a labor contract doesn't alter the appropriations. You could grant extraordinary increases or extraordinarily decreases in your labor contracts. That doesn't directly, per se, change the appropriations. It simply sets the resource and sort of changes the constraints and options available to the agencies.
Question that just I was just thinking about, if the contracts move forward, why are we moving the contract forward under the second year or the first year? Now, the reason I bring that up, for some reason I'm thinking, well, if the first year there wasn't steps and lanes, but the second year there is, can you kind of justify that or explain why that would be, Commissioner Holmes?
Mr. Chairman, that was certainly something that we looked at, or that was an issue that had to be resolved, and consulted with a number of people about are the existing terms. The existing terms have to be the ones that are in place on June 30th, and for that particular year, steps were given. The argument to go back to the first year doesn't makes sense, because it's possible if you would have had a wage increase there, you would have gone back in a way that didn't make sense. So it's something, it's pretty much agreed against labor relations practitioners that the existing terms are the ones that were in effect for the year on the date that the contract ends.
All right. Thank you. Further questions of Commissioner Showalter and Holmes? All right. Thank you two very much. Good
Thank
to see you again. Also, we have Lori Lamb, Vice Chancellor for Human Resources, Minscule. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And just introduce yourself, and let's have an update from you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lori Lamb. I'm the Vice Chancellor for Human Resources at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I am the Chief sort of Labor Relations Officer, if you will, for the system. I've also brought with me Chris Dale, who is our lead negotiator for the system, and he's here to help me out if number one, I say too much, or number two, I don't have the answer to the questions that you ask. So we're here to we'll do a little bit of a brief set of information for you if you'd like, and then we'll stand for questions.
Why don't we proceed that way?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Commissioner Showalter and Assistant Commissioner Holmes did a very nice overview of sort of how the bargaining process works, so I won't go over that again for you. I will just tell you a little bit of how we're sort of unique in this sense that we do have individual responsibility to negotiate three agreements with our faculty unions that are within the system. We have about half of our overall employee population is faculty that delivers educational and other services to our student populations directly, and those are the three that we oversee. That would be the Interfaculty Organization, which is the union that represents our state university faculty. We have the Minnesota State College Faculty Union, MSCF, which represents the faculty at our two-year community and technical colleges. And then we also have the Minnesota State University Association of Administrative and Service Faculty. We call that MUSAF. That's easier than the long term. And they really are at our state universities, and they're our direct student service providers, people like advisors, academic professionals that help students with succeeding in programs and deliver direct services to students, but just not exactly in the classroom or administrative type functions that they do. Again, that's about half of our workforce within the system. The other half are largely covered by plans that are negotiated by Minnesota Management and Budget. And then we also have our own personnel plan for MinSCU administrators that we have for executives and administrators across the system, a complete number of about 500 of those at all of our 37 institutions, including our presidents, our chancellor, other executives, et cetera. I would say that in our system, only about 5% of our employees are not covered by a collective bargaining agreement. So we are slightly different from MMB and the rest of state government in that regard. And I would also say that, just to remind you, that we do have a board of trustees that is also in between the negotiation of these contracts and them coming to you as the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. So before we bring a contract to you, not only is it ratified by the union, but it's also approved by our board of trustees. And so they have very active participation in formulating the directions we take, both with what we negotiate and then whether those contracts are approved by the board before they come forward to you. A couple other distinctions I just want to make, and then I'm happy to answer whatever questions you might have. Our units, all of our employees that we've been responsible for are also different from MMB, particularly as it relates to the last 2 years and the many questions you were just asking about the steps that are accruing now to the classified units, AFSCME, MAPE, MMA, those groups. But the last 2 years of our negotiated agreements, all three of them had no increases in them for our faculty units, and our administrators had no increases either. I would say that there were some minor increases in the IFO agreement and in the MSCF agreement related to promotions. If faculty were promoted, there was an opportunity for them to get an increase by virtue of their promotion to a new level of responsibility. But that affected less, I would say less than 5% of the employees in those units. But that would be through some additional educational requirement, getting through their probationary periods, those types of things. So other than that, there were no increases to any of the employees in the system. There were no step increases for any employee within our system in the last couple of years. I would also just say that To the extent there were increased costs, and the numbers that Mr. Hubinger can show you will show a less cost for the MinSQ system employees than that 1.69% over time, but there's a little bit of an increase there, again, because of what I said with regard to the promotional opportunities, but also because of the increased health insurance costs that we all had to experience, as well as increased pension costs. And those, again, aren't negotiated. The health insurance costs are. But I just wanted to make sure that you understand that when you see that very small number, it's largely at least two-thirds of it related to the pension costs and the health insurance costs, and very small amounts of it related to any type of salary increase that was provided to any of our employees. So with that, I think that's just a general overview. Let me say one other thing. We are in the process of negotiations as well. We have started with particularly the IFO unit and with MSCF. We are doing what is called interest-based bargaining with both the IFO right now and with MSCF. And for those of you that might not be familiar with interest-based bargaining, it's far different than sort of the traditional type of bargaining that most unions and management engage in, which is we have a proposal, we'll give it to you, you give us your response to that proposal, we'll consider it, we'll come back, and you negotiate until you meet a middle ground. Interest-based bargaining is a process, first, where we bring in experts from the Bureau of Mediation Services to do training with both teams jointly about how to have conversations that focus on getting to resolutions that address the interests of the parties. This happens most effectively with regard to the non-economic provisions of contracts that Ms. Holmes referenced, the language issues, those sort of work rule issues, and that's where we've been focusing our energies to date in what I would characterize as very productive discussions with our units about areas where we have mutual interest to try to correct, change, or supplement language within the contract that better serves all of our interests in terms of how we deliver our services going forward. With regard to the IFO, we have had 12 days so far of bargaining over the last several months, and 7 days of active bargaining with MSCF. With MUSAF, our union, we have not engaged in formal interest-based bargaining with them or bargained yet with them, but we intend to schedule that in the near future. And I would just explain a little bit about that, and it isn't for a lack of interest on either side's part. It is just that our negotiation history in the past with MUSAF has been a lot more akin to interest-based bargaining and a lot less adversarial. And so the parties are really interested in getting those economic issues out on the table and really having those kind of discussions before they go down any other path, and making sure that, you know, we stay in that sort of productive zone with them. And so it's not a lack of interest on anybody's part. We we always wait for economic issues to be resolved at the state level before we exchange economic proposals, because we have to. We have to know how much money is available to the system before we can talk about compensation interests and those types of things. We also typically do, but not always do, sort of want to have a good sense of where MMB is heading with the classified contracts and their essential units before we proceed, just so that we can understand where they are and make sure that we're there. That's not always been the case. In fact, the last year, these last contracts where we have no increases, we did settle those contracts before MMB settled their contracts. And that was at the initial suggestion of the IFO, who I think had the courage and foresight, if you will, to appreciate the difficult economic situation that both the state and the system were in, and came to us and proposed a no-increase contract for the 2 years. We obviously thought that made sense for our system, and we started there, and our settlements were reached in advance of MMB for the last contract period. Those are the contracts that are now carried forward. So the situation we find ourselves in, and I think our employees find themselves in, is in a situation where the MMB units are now getting increases and our folks are not. I just wanted to make sure you understood that clearly. That's a basic overview of where we are with bargaining. As Ms. Holmes said it's probably not a good place to come in here and talk specific strategy with you, and we appreciate your understanding of that. But we are, in my mind, making very good progress in our interest-based bargaining processes, and we do look forward in the near future to beginning to talk about some economic issues.
All right. Thank you very much. And I just want to make members aware we had scheduled this for an hour. We are right now at an hour because we started at 5 after. But I just want to make aware of your time in case you have any other schedule. Real quickly, Ms. Lamb, I'm trying to remember what we excluded Minscule from because of your great negotiating. Does anybody remember that in this last legislative session? What was that, Ms. Lamb? Do you remember?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do remember. And it was actually, there was a bill proposed for an overall salary freeze for all state employees, and Minscule was in that bill excluded from that language. That bill did not pass, but it was...
Right, but I think it at that point in time, I think what we were trying to send the message was, great job, and even though it didn't pass, and now I recall what it was. I see like five people leaning forward like they're ready to ask a question. Who's Representative Draskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Lamb. I was on this committee the last biennium, too, and I remember discussions. I remember hearing about, and I've heard actually a lot from constituents, concerns about the inflation of our president's salaries. We also, and I understand a component of that is performance-based, but, you know, being next to Winona State University, I think the president there that just retired was being paid somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000 a year or something like that. First question would be, do you have an idea of kind of what the average president's salary is if you combine the average performance given plus the base salary? And are we still compensating, if I remember, about 7 or 8 different presidents $23,000 a year for the use of their personal home to host faculty Senate meetings?
Chancellor Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Representative Draskowski, I can tell you that our presidents have not had pay increases for 2 years, much like, well, along with every other employee in our system. I can tell you that the range of presidents, we have 31 presidents now within our system, the salaries vary tremendously. I can't tell you offhand an average, but I think the lowest salary is in the $140,000 range, and the highest base salary is in the $270,000 range. So you could average those two, but we have them sort of all over the spectrum, depending upon the size and complexity of the institution, and also the difference between the market value for two-year community and technical colleges versus the state universities. There's very different market values. The universities, obviously, Winona, Minnesota State, Mankato, St. Cloud are going to be at our highest pay. Mankato and St. Cloud, because of size and complexity, would be at our highest, and I believe the two presidents there make roughly $274,000 a year. All of our presidents have the same performance pay provision. It's a provision that allows them to make an additional $15,000 per year based upon the achievement of specific goals that are articulated for them at the beginning of the year and agreed upon by the chancellor, and then their performance is viewed at that point. So that is the same for all of our presidents. You asked about the housing allowance. That is given to the 7 state university presidents, and that is what is customary for university presidents. So that's $24,000 a year that's given to the 7 state university presidents.
Further discussion? Representative Draskowski.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Lamb, is there a way that we could is there? I struggle with the it's now $24,000. I don't know anywhere else that happens. Is there a way for us to communicate to? Is it the Board of Trustees that sets that contract? I don't know. I just hear a lot of things from folks.
Chancellor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, these are things that are allowed for in the personnel plan for administrators that are approved by this committee and approved by our Board of Trustees and approved by this committee. So if you have things you would like to say about those things, I think you have the opportunity to do so.
Further questions? Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, and I have kind of a similar concern that Representative Drazkowski has mentioned. Over the last couple of years, you've had the no increases for faculty, and then you said no increases for administration. But nonetheless, we have this this huge bonus thing going on. I just think it's really I just can't imagine it sits well with the public at all. And a lot of it is, I question, you know, the performance. And right now with the economy the way it is and people retooling and whatnot, I question the real success of some of these chancellors or presidents, because I think people are driven to retooling just by the sheer economic condition. It's not that they're doing such a great job. It's just that they're in the right place at the right time, I think, more so. And I just think these bonuses, if the public would really, I guess I'd like to see what the numbers are that the previous administration has allowed these bonuses to be, and I'd just like to see a printout of those and have that provided to the committee members here. So,
all right. Is that possible, Chancellor?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly, all of that information is public information, and I can certainly work with Mr. Huebinger to determine what precise information you would like to have, and we will provide it.
All right. Thank you. Representative Winkler.
Go ahead, Dave.
Go ahead. That's fine.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lamb, I think 2 years ago the same issue came up with respect to university presidents and the chancellor, and at that time, I wrote a letter to the chairman of the Board of Trustees, Mr. Olson, and inquired about whether there were any what the conditions were, what the targets were that they were supposed to hit, and how concrete they were, or whether it was largely discretionary by the board to grant the bonuses. And I didn't get an overly informative answer in response. And so, adding to what Representative Lilly requested, if it's possible, I'd like to know how much discretion rests with the board to grant end of the year compensation based on performance versus how much of it is baked in based on numeric or objective performance criteria. So, if you could provide, I don't know if you can provide the criteria for them or what the appropriate amount of information would be, but I'm interested in knowing. To what degree this is simply a discretionary decision by the Board of Trustees versus something that is more contractual in nature.
All right. Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not to pile on here, but maybe one more request would be as we look at those, the numbers, the bonus numbers, it would also be helpful to know what was the total potential bonus that they could have earned and what they actually earned to see whether there's some accountability being applied to the metrics. But then if I could just ask a separate question, you mentioned that those salary ranges were representative of market rates. And if you could maybe just give a brief description and then maybe we can get this information from you as well more concretely. Are we at market rates for these types of positions? And then part B of that question is, does the bonus actually get them up to that market rate? In other words, they kind of got to earn their market rate, or does the bonus get added on to the market rate, and therefore we're offering very rich packages?
Chancellor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, the last data I looked at for, and it was for fiscal year 10, really, because, and salaries haven't changed in our system, but they may have changed elsewhere. For our competitiveness with respect to presidential salaries, we were at or below the 50th percentile nationally with regard to presidential salaries at the state universities, and slightly higher than that for our two-year institutions, but not much higher than that, and that's nothing to write home about, to be at or below the 50th percentile. Those numbers, as we compared, did not include the incentive pay because that is not guaranteed, and so we only compare what is guaranteed. But for presidents, that's $15,000, and that's not a very high percentage of their overall compensation, so it wouldn't change that very much. For our chancellor, who has a larger $50,000 performance incentive possibility, that would change it slightly. But in recently conducting our chancellor search and hiring a new chancellor, we did a detailed national analysis of similar systems and institutions and looked at the most similar 15 institutions nationally in terms of overall compensation, including retirement, performance incentives, base pay, housing allowance, and all of that. And we ranked 14th out of 15.
So. Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then a separate question for Mr. Hubinger. So I remember seeing the list of all of the bargaining units and seeing the MNSCU zeros, and that kind of jumped out at me because none of the other bargaining units were at zero in their previous settlements. And I'm wondering, are these aggregate numbers here that we see on the one pager that you provided inclusive of the MNSCU settlements? And maybe the real question is, and it can just be a request, do we have a similar page like this that shows kind of biennium to biennium this type of a breakdown by bargaining unit so that we could kind of see which bargaining units are at the higher end and those that are at the lower end of the settlement range?
Mr. Huminger.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, we don't have that produced, but I think that's something that we can put together for you.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Winkler.
One last question. Mr. Chair, Ms. Lamb, this is a general question. I think you can probably address it for both you and for the MMB. You said, you know, pension negotiations are off the table because they're governed by statute. Are there other types of items that could be negotiated that you're prohibited from negotiating, or items that you're not allowed to incorporate in negotiations, or provisions to include aside from pensions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, I'm looking next door, but not that I'm aware of. We have, I think both the Minnesota Management Budget folks and we enjoy full latitude to negotiate with our respective employees.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question. I remember during the Ventura years, there was a state contract negotiated with domestic partner benefits, mm-hmm. and that was, I understand, rejected. Would you, in theory, be able to negotiate the same another domestic partner benefit package and send it back to the legislature now, or why hasn't been an issue, I don't think, since the Ventura years? So I'm wondering why not.
Chancellor Lamb.
Mr. Chair and Representative Winkler, my understanding, I wasn't here at the time, but my understanding of that is that the coalition bargaining that Ms. Holmes referred to, that is how insurance is negotiated, and by that coalition, I mean it's not separate unions, and we don't do that separately. We're a member of that coalition, and we help with that. That coalition bargaining resulted in inclusion of a domestic partner benefit. This is my understanding, and Ms. Holmes can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that that was included through the negotiation process. When it came to the subcommittee, that domestic partner language was removed, and so that's how it came out. So we could not independently, MNSCU, negotiate that because insurance and eligibility, insurance and the type of benefit provided is not something we have authority to negotiate. That's done through coalition bargaining. Am I talking right, Bob? She'll tell me if I'm wrong.
Further questions? All right. There's no further question, Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, I'm reminded from Chris, from my associate here, Chris Dale, that it was actually the full legislature, not the subcommittee, that rejected that particular language and removed that from the insurance plan at that time. So I it's a good clarification.
Would you like to add to that at all?
Mr. Chair, it was just that the legislature rejected those contracts, and consistent with the way the legislature approaches those, they were rejected in toto because of those provisions, and the contracts were resubmitted. And then during the course of the summer following that legislative session, and were renegotiated and resubmitted to the subcommittee without that benefit.
We can add that in here then.
Okay. No further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, committee, that'll wrap up our first meeting. You have some paperwork to fill out. Please do that before you leave, and leave with me, and I'll take care of it. And we will work on some of these reports with Mr. Huberger and make sure we get them out to you, okay? All right, with that, the subcommittee is adjourned.
That's good.